I want to thank the parish of St. Nicholas Orthodox Church for coming up with the idea and sponsoring this and giving me the opportunity to share it. I am so excited to bring this material to you because while it is well known in places where I have lived, like Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and even to a certain extent in Nairobi and Kenya, it is almost totally unknown outside of there. And so I hope this will be as interesting and as fascinating to you as it is to me, and I hope it will be some new things for you too, things you've never heard of, things you that will go, my goodness, why did nobody ever tell me this before? So so that's what I'm looking forward to sharing with you. And I think what I would like to do first is just to make this statement, and it may be shocking to some of you. It would certainly be shocking to people of my age who grew up in a university environment here in the United States and in Europe. It's important at the very beginning to state that, from the beginning of this lecture, that Christianity in Africa is not a white man's religion. Now, this was a hot topic back when I was in university, back in the 1970s and the 1980s, and all of the literature was hot over this, and Christianity was quite discredited, at least in academic circles, because it was seen as the purveyor of colonialism, either being naively complicit with colonialism or actually fomenting and fostering a colonial presence in Africa itself. And so that's one of the reasons why it was very, very controversial. Most people here in the West assume that Christianity comes to Africa from Western missionaries. And let me see if I can get this to work now. There we go. This little church is actually 4 miles away from where I lived in Nairobi. It's a Scottish missionary and some of his early converts, Presbyterian Scott, Scottish church there in Thugoto, which is a little tiny village now almost enveloped by Nairobi. So Protestant missionaries, Western missionaries, were closely associated with the whole colonial enterprise that blighted the continent in the 19th and 20th centuries. Roman Catholics, let's see if we can get this. I might have to stand a little bit shorter that way. Sorry, we're just learning the technology here. There we go. Roman Catholics came to the scene earlier with priests accompanying explorers and traders who were bent on furthering the territorial and economic aspirations of the great Catholic powers, Spain and Portugal in this case. And the efforts of these mission priests succeeded in establishing mission stations all down the western coast of Africa and all up the eastern coast of Africa. And their efforts led to the conversion of at least one African ruler, Nzidi Nkuu, and much of his kingdom of Congo, which stretched across present-day northern Angola. And the resulting history of Roman Catholicism in Africa and the astonishing scramble of Protestant missionaries to plant their many churches across the continent is relatively well known. But what is less well known is that Christianity existed in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, before the first Portuguese priests made contact with the local inhabitants in the 15th century along the continent's western coast. In fact, there was a thriving Christian church in sub-Saharan Africa for more than 1,000 years before Western missionaries arrived on the scene and began the free-for-all denominational scrum that continues to this very day. Christianity arrived in sub-Saharan Africa in an unexpected and surprising way. It took root and produced an African church with its own hierarchy, with the liturgy translated into its own African language, with its own style of church architecture, with its own set of African saints, and over the course of centuries developed its own traditions. It's a church that not only has survived until this day, but some of the major it's one of the major communions of global Christianity, with more than 40 million adherents. That's why when I'm asked, what does African Christianity look like? I tell them, if you want to experience what genuine African Christianity is like, then go and visit the Ethiopian or Eritrean Orthodox Tewahedo Church. So I want to tell you the story of how this church got started, because it's a story little known outside of Ethiopia. Now, the minute one presumes to say something about the origins of Christianity in Africa, one wades into intractable controversy, because wasn't Africa evangelized by the Ethiopian eunuch? Wasn't Africa evangelized by the Ethiopian eunuch? Luke's account of Philip's encounter with the African government official in Acts 8 seems straightforward. But I put those three words in quotation marks for a reason, because each one represents assumptions on our part that may or may not be true, or which may at least be misleading. In case we're unfamiliar with it, let me read this story to you. And there was an Ethiopian, a eunuch, a court official of Candace, the queen of the Ethiopians, who was in charge of all of her treasure. He had come to Jerusalem to worship and was returning seated in his chariot. And he was reading the prophet Isaiah. Now, the official is reading a passage from the prophecy of Isaiah about someone who was like a sheep being led to the slaughter. And Philip asks him if he understands what he's reading. And the official asks, who is the prophet talking about, himself or someone else? Then Philip, beginning with this scripture, told him the good news about Jesus. And as they were going down the road, they came to some water. And the eunuch said, see, here's water. What prevents me from being baptized? And he commanded the chariot to stop, and they both went down to the water, and he baptized him. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord carried Philip away. The eunuch saw him no more, and he went on his way rejoicing. Now, the challenge when reading a passage like this is that we're often limited by our own experiences or perspectives in how we choose to interpret this. Take the term Ethiopian, for example. Most people today would, without hesitation, assume that by Ethiopian, Luke means someone from Ethiopia, which we would equate with modern-day Ethiopia. But in New Testament days, there was no such place called Ethiopia. Luke could have said that the eunuch was from Aksum, but he didn't. Instead, he uses the ordinary way people like the eunuch were described in his days. Ethiopian comes from a Greek word that, as early as Homer in the 6th century BC, meant burnt face. That is, he was referring to dark-skinned people. And it's likely that the Ethiopian in Luke's account from the area south of Egypt that the Hebrew Bible calls Cush, in which the Greek translation called the Septuagint translates as Ethiopia. So while Luke knows precisely what he's talking about, our own presuppositions tend to jump in and confuse matters. So you can see here, this is the Nile coming down here. You've got Lower Egypt, Upper Egypt, and Nubia here, and this area called Cush down here. It's all along the Nile. So when the Old Testament is referring to Cush, this is the part that they're referring to. And in the Greek translation, it more often than not is translated as having to do with Ethiopia or Ethiopians. Now, a second matter has to do with the person the eunuch is serving. Luke describes this person as Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. And once again, our first inclination is to interpret Candace as a proper name, just as we might say Elizabeth, queen of of Great Britain. Because of this, we might be tempted to think that Luke is fabricating history, because there's no record of any queen named Candace serving anywhere in the world at that time. But a little digging uncovers the interesting fact that Candace refers not to a person, but it's a title. Candace. Further exploration reveals that Candace refers to a woman who ruled either as a regent during the minority of her son or as empress in her own right. Moreover, the Candace ruled not over Ethiopia, but over a kingdom called Meroe, a kingdom south of Egypt at the confluence of the Takasi and the Nile rivers. Whoops. There we go. So Meroe, the ruins of Meroe, are still here. You can see it. You can see it's north of modern-day Khartoum, but it's south of Nubia, south of the area called Kush. Now, we're not told anything else in Luke's account. We don't know what happened to the man. We don't know if he became an evangelist for his new faith, and if so, if he met with any success among his own people. We're not even told if any new churches were started as a result of his effort. We're just given the singular example of an African man responding to the good news by Philip. So here's a case where we've got textual evidence, the book of Acts, of the conversion of an African man who was an official of the Candace of Meroe. And while we do not have corroborating evidence that would enable us to say this absolutely happened, we also do not have evidence that would cause us to question the veracity of Luke's account. So, does this mean that we've dealt with the issue of the Ethiopian eunuch and the beginnings of Christianity in Africa? Ha, if only. Unfortunately, it gets a bit more complicated. So now we get to go to the interesting picture here. There we go. When I was living in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, I had the privilege of meeting Abuna Palos of blessed memory. He's the patriarch of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. In his reception room, along with a group of students from my daughter's school, that's my daughter to my right there, in case you were wondering. So on one of the walls in that very room was a beautiful painted icon filling the entire wall of the conversion of the Ethiopian eunuch. Now, it turns out the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church officially traces their origin to the conversion of the man recorded by Luke. So Christianity was then brought to Ethiopia. Through his efforts, the church had its beginning there. Now, that's one of the major strands of tradition within the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And if that were not enough, Eusebius writes in his ecclesiastical history, and I have Father Robert to thank for bringing this passage to my attention, but as the preaching of the Savior's gospel was daily advancing, a certain providence led from the land of the Ethiopians an officer of the queen of that country, for Ethiopia, even to the present day, is ruled according to ancestral custom by a woman. He, first among the Gentiles, interestingly enough, received of the mysteries of the divine word from Philip in consequence of a revelation, and having become the first fruits of believers throughout the world, he is said to have been the first on returning to his country to proclaim the knowledge of the God of the universe and the life-giving sojourn of our Savior among men, so that through him, in truth, the prophecy obtained its fulfillment, which declares that Ethiopia stretcheth out her hand unto God. And that's a quote from Psalm 68, verse 31, I believe. So in this case, the tradition held by the Ethiopian Orthodox Church and also found in Eusebius indicates that the man converted under Philip's ministry went on to be the means of the gospel coming to the Ethiopians. Now, there's several options as to what's going on here. Option number one, the gospel may indeed have been first brought to Ethiopia by this official. He may have preached among his own people, and his preaching may have resulted in conversions, and churches may have been established, in which case he would have been the apostle to the Ethiopians, and the icon in the Abuna's reception hall would have been accurately presenting the origin of the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church. Option number two. Secondly, the gospel may indeed have been brought to the Ethiopians by the official, but as we've seen, the Ethiopians of these early documents in no way correspond to who we today understand Ethiopians to be. If this is the case, then it's plausible that Eusebius is passing on accurate information about the origins of a church among the Ethiopians. It's just that his use of Ethiopian corresponds to historical Meroe and the surrounding peoples along the Upper Nile and its tributaries. This would mean that there's probably no continuity between the events recorded in Acts 8 and the origins of the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church. This also does not imply that there is historical continuity between Acts 8 and the later Christian kingdoms along the Nile that persisted until the 14th century. And their story is fascinating, but there's no time to do any of that justice here because I want to do some other things. Thirdly, both Eusebius and Ethiopian tradition may be involved in reconstructing history and tradition by word association. Eusebius is aware of the prophecy in Psalm 68:31 that Ethiopia will stretch forth her hand to God. And the story of the Ethiopian eunuch's conversion may just be too tempting a plot line not to fill out in order to prove the fulfillment of prophecy. The same with the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. There may be an eagerness to view any biblical reference to Ethiopia or to Ethiopians as referring to their own experience and their own people and their own history, and thus to contemporary Ethiopia. But as we have seen, Ethiopia does not necessarily mean Ethiopia, and an Ethiopian is not necessarily an Ethiopian. Got that? So among the challenges posed here is to figure out the difference between legitimate tradition, capital T, that which is handed down from the apostles to the present day, along with that which the church holds as authoritative. So the difference between that and legend. Eusebius is writing some 300 years after the events he discussed. What are his sources? Are they conveying information that is accurate, or are they taking liberty with the historical record for polemical reasons? And the same questions need to be asked of the EOTC's tradition, according to the Ethiopian eunuch. What are their sources? Do they reflect unbroken tradition, big T tradition, from the event itself, or do the sources betray a fabrication of history, again, for polemical reasons? Now, the great problem here is that we just don't know. We ourselves are not acquainted with the sources, either used either by Eusebius or by the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. We cannot, therefore, make a judgment based on evidence, one way or the other. What we are left with are our own prejudices, the very things that we are inclined to accuse our ancient sources of harboring. So while it's not safe either to validate the accounts presented by Eusebius and the Ethiopian Orthodox Church of the connection between Acts 8 and Ethiopian Christianity, it's also not safe to nullify those accounts. We're already aware of how easy it is to misinterpret passages because we aren't fully acquainted with what certain significant words, in this case, Candace or Ethiopian, may mean in their context. This makes us cautious of being quick to dismiss a scripture passage or a church tradition as being in error. It's just as likely that we are the ones who are in error. So at the present time, we can say that the Acts 8 account of the Ethiopian eunuch likely refers to an African man serving in the court of the Kandake and Meroe in present-day Sudan. Eusebius and the tradition of the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church recount that this man's subsequent ministry resulted in Christianity being introduced to the Ethiopians. Presently, there's no corroborating evidence of a mid to late first century church in Aksum, for example. or areas that might plausibly be considered to be Ethiopia at the time. However, as is often said, an absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It just means that we can only report the claims, the issues, and the current state of the evidence as they presently are, which means the most that we can say currently with respect to Acts chapter 8 and the origins of the Ethiopian church is a resounding maybe. Now, there's a further significant problem facing any historian of Christianity in Africa in general, and Christianity in the Aksumite and later Ethiopian Empire in particular. Very little ancient material, whether written, architectural, inscriptional, survives, from which one can reconstruct or construct an evidence-based history for the first 1,300 years of the church's history in that part of the world. And for Ethiopia, at least, the reason for this is pretty clear. This is because of the 16th century conquest of Ethiopia by Imam Ahmad ibn Ibrahim al-Ghazi in Amharic, known as Ahmed Gran, in Somali, known as Ahmed Gure. He was likely from one of the Somali clans. He was a general of the Sultan of Adal, and he led a Somali army on a murderous assault on the Ethiopian Empire, first defeating the Emperor Lebna Dingal in 1529 and breaking his power altogether in October 28, 1531 at the Battle of Ambasel. Ahmed Gran sought to conquer Christian Ethiopia in the name of Islam. He systematically destroyed the churches and the monasteries in his path. Manuscripts were burned, artwork and iconography were destroyed. It's like, sound familiar? From 1529 to 1543, Ahmed Gran, his efforts brought three quarters of Ethiopia under the control of the Muslim Sultanate of Adal. Ethiopia may have survived just barely, but Ethiopia lost her history during his campaigns. Now, a small contingent of Portuguese soldiers landed at Massawa on the coast. It's in present-day Eritrea. It's interesting. In Mogadishu, he's the good guy. The Portuguese, this should be surprising to us. What are they doing in Ethiopia? They were actually looking for Prester John. Anybody who's a student of medieval history will know that from the Crusades, there had been rumors of a Christian king who led a great army who could come to the aid and deliver the Holy Land from the Muslim infidels. And so there had been a search for Prester John since that particular time. So here they are. They're looking for Prester John, among other things, which we won't get into here. In this case, they found a Christian king, but one who was in real deep trouble. The Emperor Galadaros enlisted their aid. The Portuguese, who were just a few hundred in number, were led by Christopher da Gama, who was the son, if you remember your history, of Vasco da Gama, the great Portuguese explorer. Though the Portuguese were vastly outnumbered by the Muslim army of Ahmed Gran, they possessed muskets, and the tide began to turn. On April 1, 1542, the Portuguese and the Ethiopians engaged Ahmed Gran in a bloody series of battles. Christopher da Gama was wounded and captured with some of his men during the campaign, and when he refused to convert to Islam, he and his men were executed. Does this sound familiar? Emperor Galadaros rallied the remaining Ethiopians and Portuguese and re-engaged the Muslim army on February 21st, 1543 at the Battle of Wainadaga. And the 9,000-strong Ethiopian force managed to defeat a much larger Muslim force of 15,000. Ahmed Gran himself was shot by a Portuguese soldier and killed, avenging Da Gama's death. Here is a contemporary Ethiopian rendition of that battle and that death. Ahmed Gran set out to conquer Christian Ethiopia. Despite 700 years of Islamic tradition, Ethiopia had long been designated as a, quote, land of neutrality, end quote, and was not to be attacked, nor were its people to be subject to forced conversion. A Muslim hadith or tradition explains that the Aksumite king of Muhammad's day offered sanctuary to some of Muhammad's relatives and followers when the early community was being persecuted. Another hadith states that the Aksumite king was so moved by the prophet's revelations that he secretly converted to Islam. One way or the other, for centuries, the kingdom of Aksum and then Ethiopia was untouched by Islamic invaders during a time of the otherwise dramatic expansion of Islam in Asia, Africa, and Europe, with the exception of Ahmed Gran. So this is the reason why so much of Ethiopia's actual history and its cultural heritage is lost to us today. It was destroyed during the Islamist campaign of Ahmed Gran. And Ethiopia itself almost went the way of the Christian Nubian kingdoms along the Nile, all of which were finally swamped by Islamic armies after centuries of Christians maintaining a Christian presence and witness on the Nile south of Egypt. That being said, there is still a surprising tale to be told, and there is evidence to back it up. For what follows, I'm indebted to a particularly gifted scholar and teacher who happens to be the mother of my children, Stephanie Black. She wrote an article called In the Power of God Christ, Greek Inscriptional Evidence for the Anti-Aryan Theology of Ethiopia's First Christian King. And it's found in the bulletin of the School of Oriental and African Studies. Stuart Munro Hay states this: of all the ancient civilizations of the past, go back here, that of the ancient Ethiopian kingdom of Aksum remains perhaps the least known. This gives you an idea of Aksum at its greatest extent. It wasn't always stretching up to the Nile. Usually, it was in this area here, and also here.
Phil?
Yeah?
I'm sorry. Is that map indicating a land bridge?
No, it's indicating a political connection between the Sabaeans and Aksum. The emperor of Aksum controlled across into present-day Yemen. Thanks for asking, though. So, of all the important, this is the one least known. That being said, recent archaeological excavations have contributed significantly to what we know, both of the history of Aksum and its social and political organization. In particular, both inscriptions and coins have come to light relating to the introduction of Christianity in Aksum. A parallel strand of Ethiopian Orthodox tradition traces its beginning to the Emperor Izana's conversion around 330 AD. Four fourth century stela written in Izana's name trace his own dramatic religious pilgrimage. Two of the stela carry the same text in Greek and Ge'ez, which is the language that was spoken in Aksum at the time. You might be surprised to know that Greek was spoken in Aksum. The reason Greek was spoken in Aksum is that Greek was the lingua franca. It was the English of the day. And so anybody doing business along the ports of the Red Sea would have come across people speaking Greek because they're trading with the Roman Empire to the north and on out to India, to the south and to the east. So these stela have inscriptions in Greek and Ge'ez and also Sabaean. So that sets us up. And now let me tell you the story. It comes to us through the early Christian historian Rufinus, who lived from 345. Oh, and these are some pictures of Aksum today, some of the monumental architecture. And this has to do with the trade, and I think I'll stop right here, because the first part of our story involves a ship. According to Rufinus, a merchant from Tyre named Meropius decided to travel to India, which might be referring to the ports along the southern Red Sea, or it might be referring to India, we don't know. He was joined by the brothers who were probably teenagers at the time. They were Christians. On their return, they put in at a port called Adulis on the coast of present-day Eritrea. But Adulis had suspended its treaty with the Romans, and Meropius and all of the crew were massacred. But the two teenage boys were spared, and they were handed over to the ruler, who happened to be the emperor of Aksum. He was very impressed with their abilities, especially with the one named Frumentius. His brother was named Odysseus. And the emperor eventually made Odysseus his cupbearer and Frumentius his steward. The emperor died, and his queen served as regent for her son Izana, the heir. And she asked Frumentius to share the responsibility of governing the country with her. So during the time Frumentius took advantage, of the opportunity to build churches for the Roman merchants who passed through. And again, this is Rufinus's account that I'm relating to you. At some point, after the prince attained his maturity and was crowned an emperor, I was looking for some models of Roman ships just to give you a sense of what could be going up and down the Red Sea. At some point, after the prince attained his maturity and was crowned emperor, Odysseus was given permission to return to Tyre, and Frumentius was sent to Alexandria with orders to obtain a bishop for the country, because by then, Christianity had been rooted and grounded in Aksum, and the emperor had become a Christian. And when he arrived, guess who was bishop of Alexandria? The one we call Saint Athanasius the Great. Frumentius explained the growth of the church among the Ethiopians and delivered Izana's request for a bishop, and Athanasius was led to consecrate Frumentius to be that bishop, and he sent him right back to Aksum to complete the work that he had begun. Now, up until that time, there were a number of different religions that were practiced in the regions controlled by the emperor in Aksum, including a religion that worshipped the serpent, another religion that worshipped the moon. Judaism was practiced in parts of Ethiopia at the time. And the Greek gods, the old Greek gods, were worshipped among some of the elite as well. So it's into this pluralistic context, in this pluralistic society, that the Christian teenagers Frumentius and Odysseus began to practice and explain their own faith, especially to members of the royal family who they were working with. And at some point, the members of the royal family and the leading members of the Aksumite society made decisions to become Christians. And at some point, the emperor himself, Izana, embraced Christianity both for himself and as the religion for his kingdom. Now, Izana is mentioned further by the 4th and 5th century Christian historian Rufinus, this time in relation to the controversy with Arianism. By 356, Arianism was more or less the controlling theology of the Eastern Roman Empire. The Emperor Constantius had sided with the Arian party and was himself an Arian. He had deposed Athanasius, among others, from his see and their sees, sent them into exile. Constantius then wrote, among other things, he wrote a letter that's been preserved to the emperor Izana and to his son Cezanus, asking them, in quotes, to send Frumentius to the bishop of to send Frumentius, the bishop of Axum, to Egypt so that his faith might be tested. Now, there's no record of their response, but it's obvious that they did not comply. So that's the story as it comes to us from the Ethiopian church tradition and from the historian Rufinus. But what about any evidence? Is this just another case where we have a story plus some assumptions but no actual corroboration? Amazingly, four stela dating from the time of Izana's reign in the 4th century have been discovered. And here are three of them. The fourth one is leaning against a wall someplace else, not in this room. Probably they served as inscription markers beside each of the major roads as they entered into the city. Today they're propped up in a small shelter near the central area where Axum's famous obelisks stand. And the four stelae represent three phases of Izana's religious transition. The first two are nearly identical, and they relate in both Greek and Ge'ez Izana's victory over the adjacent ethnic group that had rebelled against his rule. And Izana presents himself as the son of the unconquered god Ares, who was a Greek god. The third inscription is written in Ge'ez only and gives the account of Izana's victory over the Noba people. In this inscription, Izana makes reference to the Lord of Heaven and Lord of all. Some people see this as evidence of Izana's transition from polytheism to monotheism. Now, scholars have debated back and forth. Of course, scholars have to have something to debate. They've debated this for years, whether the monotheism was pagan monotheism or Jewish monotheism or Christian monotheism in nature. And they can't figure out which it is. This is an example of the writing on some of these stela. Oops, go back. So you can see it would be a challenge to transliterate, to get a correct reading of all of this, and that it's taken a lot of hard work by a number of people to do that. Okay. What I want to do now is to read to you the fourth stela. It was published in 1970, so not all that long ago. This is what Izana says: by faith in God and by the power of the Father and Son and Holy Spirit, to the one who saved the kingdom for me by faith in his Son Jesus Christ, to the one who helped me and always helps me, I, Izanus, king of the Axumites and the Himyarites and Vridan and the Sabaeans and of Silel and of Kaso and the Bejas and the Tamao, Bisi Alene, the son of Ele Amida, a servant of Christ, gives thanks to the Lord my God. And I am not able to tell the full measure of his favor, because my mouth and my mind are not able to tell all the gracious things which he has done for me, that he made me strong and powerful, and gave me a great name through his Son, in whom I believed. And he made me leader of all my kingdom because of faith in Christ, and his will, by his will and the power of Christ, because he himself led me, and in him I believe, and he himself became my leader. I went out to make... I think I need to go further. There we go. Okay, sorry about that. I got carried away. I went out to make war in the Noba, because the Mangatho and Kasa and Atiaditai and the Bereotai cried out against them, saying, "The Noba have made us suffer. Help us, because they oppressed us, killing us." And I rose up in the power of God Christ, in whom I believed. And he led me, and I went up from Axum in the Axumite month of Magabithe on the 8th day, a Saturday, by faith in God, and I reached Mambaria, and from that place I provisioned my army. Now this inscription is significant, not just because Izana, the emperor of Axum, is clearly writing as a Christian and from a Christian perspective, but he's writing from a Nicene Athanasian perspective. And the significance of this can hardly be overstated. Now, in 318, the Alexandrian priest Arius began teaching that Jesus was not God, that he was not co-eternal, not the co-equal Son of God, the Father, but was a created being, and in some sense divine, but subordinate to the Father. Now, Arius was a gifted teacher and a gifted songwriter, and his views spread quickly throughout the Eastern churches. And the Emperor Constantine, having just reunited the Roman Empire under his rule, faced a new division of the Roman world, this time in the Christian church. So under his leadership, a council was called to resolve the issues dividing the church. And this council, held at Nicaea in 325, rejected Arius' teaching. Nevertheless, Arianism continued to grow in influence throughout the Eastern Empire through the middle of the 4th century. Gerald Bray, a church historian, says this: Constantine tried to patch things up with Arius in 332, and he swung away from the Nicene Orthodox diehards who refused to compromise. This position remained the official imperial policy until 361, when Julian the Apostate renounced Christianity altogether. Julian died in battle in 363, and his successor Jovian reverted to Orthodoxy, but he died soon thereafter. In 363, his successor, Valens, leaned once more towards Arianism, and so it can be said with justice that Arian sympathizers ruled the state for 43 of the 56 years which separated the Council of Nicaea from that of Constantinople in 381, compared with only 11 years in which the Orthodox were in the ascendant. As Stephanie Black observes, for much of the 4th century, official Christianity was Arian, especially in the East. However, as Black's article makes the case for the connection between the most influential of the remaining voices speaking out for Nicene Christianity, Athanasius, and the Christianity we glimpse in Axum, found on the 4th Isana Stella. When Frumentius traveled to Alexandria and passed on the king's request for a bishop for Axum's fledgling church, it was Athanasius who consecrated him and sent him back as the first bishop of Axum. And Black argues, thus it's not beyond reason to postulate that Frumentius shared, or came to share, Athanasius' anti-Arian Christology, and by implication that Frumentius' influence shaped Isana's own understanding of who Christ is. But all of this was not done in a vacuum. Axum may have been on the periphery of the Roman world, but it was not outside the concern of the emperors who lived there, most likely because of the crucial role played by Axum in trade with India. So Constantius II, who reigned until 361, the second son of Constantine, was emperor from 337 to 361. Constantius was disturbed enough by Isana and Frumentius to send that letter requesting that Isana and send Frumentius to Alexandria to have his theology examined by Bishop George, the pro-Arian usurper who replaced Athanasius in 356. In his letter, Constantius calls on Frumentius to prove that he is, quote, in no respect opposed to the laws of the church and the established faith, that is, Arianism. Moreover, Frumentius is warned that it will surely be very evident that he had been induced by the persuasions of the wicked Athanasius, thus to indulge in piety against God, that is, to hold Nicene Christianity. So it would seem that Isana and Frumentius ignored the letter from far away Constantinople. There's no record of any such journey to Alexandria. In fact, except for a few surviving coins from Isana's reign, we have no further evidence of Christianity in Axum at this early date. It's interesting. We've got the same progression that we can see here. This depicts the emperor, and above him, you can see it depicts a crescent moon, which would be a symbol of the worship of that particular deity. Oops. Oh, come back. There we go. This is a coin. These two coins reflect, obviously, a Christian perspective. You can see the crosses along the scroll of each side there. But this is what we do have as I come to an end. we have evidence of a sub-Saharan African kingdom embracing Christianity in the 4th century. We have evidence of that kingdom aligning, we have evidence of the ruler of that kingdom aligning himself with the high Christology of the Nicene Council. And though we don't have time now to substantiate this, this is an African church, an African Christianity that has continued to flourish on African soil in an African context until the present day. True, the Roman Catholic Church has a huge and growing presence in Africa, as do the Protestant and Pentecostal churches. But it's only been relatively recently that these Christian churches have been able to shake their association with their colonial past and make strides toward becoming indigenous rather than mission churches. In Ethiopia, however, we are taken all of the way back to the Christianity of the Council of Nicaea. And sure, there have been subsequent developments along with seasons of decline and seasons of renewal. And the case can be made that Christianity, an African Christianity, has been faithfully preserved and passed down from one generation to another for 1,700 years. There is so much more that we could talk about, from the coming of the nine saints in the 5th and 6th century and the introduction of monasticism that they brought, to the astonishing 13th century rock churches of Lalibela, to the resistance to Catholic and later Protestant attempts to subvert and convert the Ethiopian church and so on, but we'll leave that for another time. I think it's enough tonight to get a glimpse of how it all got started. So I'd like to stop that there because I have a feeling I've stimulated some questions. I may or may be able to answer them or may not be able to, but I'll give it a try. In the meantime, what I've got, I'll scroll through some things that reflect something of the contemporary Ethiopian Orthodox Church, both its icons and some scenes from it, so long as I don't get distracted by other things. So, is there any questions? Yeah, Vladimir.
Bill, how much can you share about the Jewish roots that were there? And you know, from that coin, it looked like Ezana was not a Jewish king. He was some kind of pagan king before he converted to Christianity. And you mentioned there was some Jewish element in Ethiopia before that. And I just know that they have the Ark of the Covenant or claim to have the Ark of the Covenant. And I'm just wondering what was the kind of Jewish presence there before that? And did that make it more conducive perhaps to adopting Christianity or less? Or just anything on that?
What a great question, and we could spend an awful long time going into some fascinating things, some scurrilous and spurious things as well. But this taps into the great national myth of Ethiopia, which is that. Ties into the story of the Queen of Sheba going to visit Solomon. And the biblical account is that the Queen of Sheba was shown Solomon's favor. And she brought a lot of gifts to him, and he sent her back with a lot of gifts as well. But according to the Geber Nagast, the myth of Ethiopia, she also came back carrying his son. And he was born, given the name of Menelik, and he grew up, he was to be the king of the Sabaeans. And at some point, he traveled back to meet his father in Jerusalem. And among other things, absconded with the Ark of the Covenant and all kinds of other stuff. So goes the story. Which is how that strand of the tradition says they got a hold of the Ark of the Covenant. And then that's where a particular dynasty who was trying to justify its overthrow of another dynasty in the 14th century, that's how they justified their lineage. They trace it all the way, the kings all the way back to Solomon. So that's that tradition. What other people think is that there were actual Jews who came from Palestine down the Red Sea coast of Arabia and migrated across into Aksum and practiced their religion and made converts there. That may have happened. We know that there were Jews in Arabia at that time, and that could be a source of it. What we also know is that I was even reading this morning the prophecy of Jeremiah. We have a record of Jews coming down the Nile, fleeing from difficulties going on in Jerusalem and in Judea and whatnot, settling on Elephantine Island, for example, where there are definitely Jewish archaeological remains that are there, and eventually continuing up the Blue Nile into Ethiopia, and perhaps bringing with them the Ark of the Covenant, because they were fleeing at a time of great national emergency, for example, either the Assyrian takeover or the Babylonian takeover. So those are the theories. This is the fact. The Jews, the Beit Israel, people call them falashes, but that's actually a pejorative term. The Beit Israel, the House of Israel in Ethiopia, the black Jews, they did DNA testing back 20, 30 years ago. And not only are they genetically Jewish, but they carry the Kohen mutation. And Kohen is the priestly family mutation. And that is why Israel has airlifted every single one that wanted to leave and go to Israel. So now almost the entire community is now in Israel. The other thing is that their form of Judaism does not resemble the form of Judaism that uses synagogue worship. It uses the form of Judaism that's pre-Talmudic, which means pre-Babylonian captivity. So this form of the Judaism that came into Ethiopia predates the Babylonian captivity, whatever else you want to say about it. So it's fascinating stuff. They have something there in Aksum today, and nobody believes it. So,
thank you.
Yeah?
Thanks for that one.
I didn't quite get a look at the map to my satisfaction. Here I am asking a second annoying map question, Bill. Sorry.
Oh, I love maps.
What modern political designations do we have, or what was Aksum?
Well, Aksum is Aksum today. In terms of the city of Aksum, where the ruins are, it's still the city of Aksum.
Sudan?
No, it's in Ethiopia.
In Ethiopia.
So I could flip back to...
Well, don't go that far, it's okay.
To the map.
But yeah. Thank you.
So sure. We're on map questions.
Sure.
Was Sheba considered a place in modern-day Yemen?
Yes.
Okay. So like the Queen of Sheba, maybe... She was the queen of where Yemen is and then stretching over across the strait.
Biblical Sheba is old Saba, and they would be called the Sabaeans.
Okay.
And there's, if you go to Aksum today, they will actually take you there and they will show you the Queen of Sheba's palace, supposedly. Probably not, because she was probably across the straits there in Yemen. But as you saw, the Aksumite kingdom ruled both Yemen and Aksum in larger or lesser amounts for hundreds of years.
Follow on more.
Sure.
More in line with the early Christianity. There's a tradition that St. Andrew went down to Africa to assist St. Matthew in a struggle against a demon. On the shores of one of the lakes, and I forget which one, but definitely sub-Saharan Africa. Are you familiar with that at all?
Because no, that's interesting. I'd love to hear more about it. Because
yeah, there's a Greek author that was instructed by his editor not to write a life of St. Andrew, because that's already been done, but write a life of what St. Andrew could have done according to every single legend.
Right. St. Andrew shows up many places.
Right, the founder of Scotland.
And Ukraine, and...
Yeah. Right. planted the cross at Balaam.
Yep. Any other questions?
You've done such a nice job outlining some of the major questions, queries, and issues. Without getting too far in the weeds and stuff that lay people can understand, what are some of the remaining pressing questions actually on the front burner of the scholarship now that are answerable? of the many things that you put before us so nicely, what's the scholarship actually trying to wrestle with at the current time?
Well, again, we struggle with the lack of evidence.
Does that pretty much put the kibosh on most everything?
It hinders everything. Because if you don't have corroborating evidence, you have the traditions that have come down informing you that. For example, there are traditions that when Hamid Gram was making his depredations to Ethiopia, that they took the Ark of the Covenant away from Aksum, took it to Lake Tana first, which is a big lake in the north central part of the country. And when he approached there, they took it down to another volcano in the far south and another lake, and it was there for several generations. And you know, so there's all these interesting local traditions that highlight this movement, but there's actually no way to verify it because there's no evidence to corroborate the story. And so there's some interesting, fascinating things. I mean, even this, the stuff with the Ark of the Covenant, or even the stuff I mentioned with the history of Israel, the most tangible stuff is the DNA evidence, because otherwise we're left with the history of traditions.
So the body of those four stela, that's really kind of one off. There's not a whole lot of that going on.
No, there isn't. There's a very famous temple that's like 30 or 40 kilometers to the east and south of Aksum. It's the ruins of the temple, and it's in somebody's backyard. And there's no inscription, there's no nothing there. It's just there, and they dated it to like 2,500 years ago. And it's just there, and nobody knows what it is. They call it the Temple of the Moon, but nobody knows what it's there. So there are different things like that are there, because even with some of the archaeology there, you can do carbon dating and things like that and get a sense of the date. But if you don't have something interpreting it, it's very, very difficult to come up with any kind of conclusions. You can do what I was doing and say, well, it might be this, and it might be this, and it might be this, and ultimately we just don't know.
Mm-hmm. This may be a very basic question, and I'm
basic questions are
by your answer. But what you're saying is the idea of the eunuch who brought Christianity to Ethiopia is what the Ethiopian church accepts as the origin of its Christian tradition. What would a hierarch in the church in Ethiopia say about this alternative theory? Do they accept that there could be some truth to this? Do they see that the two could coexist? Or would this be, not heresy, but would it raise an eyebrow that
Okay? That's a great question. Saint Frumentius is a saint in the Ethiopian church. They see him as the founder, the first bishop of the Ethiopian church,
okay,
of the Church of Aksum. And they have this tradition here. So the answer to that question is yes and yes. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, it's not a very academic question, but where do you reside? You know, where in Africa? Is it in Kenya or in Ethiopia? And as a missionary, what do you do? Do you do research or?
Thank you. Back in 1980, I went as a student and was there for a summer. I lived with a Kenyan pastor and his family for a summer, and lived in their house. And they were in the boonies with no running water and no electricity. And I would follow the pastor around to the different churches. And he would take me someplace and say, okay, your turn to preach. And I'm like, okay. So I then directed InterVarsity Christian Fellowship short-term mission program in Kenya for 4 years in the 1980s. It's during that time that I realized that if I, you know, that I could possibly make a difference here, because people so desperately needed theological training to be effective in what they were trying to do. My problem was I didn't have any theological education either, so I needed to go and go back to school, and so I did that, and I got some experience as a Christian pastor. I was actually a Presbyterian pastor for 22 years. And I got my PhD so that I could teach at a higher level the new generation of leaders for, in this case, the church in Ethiopia, because that's where we went in 2000. And we were in Addis Ababa from 2000 to 2008. And then we moved to Nairobi from 2008 to, which is where I was when I was last living there a year or two ago. And I'm hoping to go back to Nairobi, this time as an Orthodox Christian, and training Orthodox priests and leaders to be more effective in their churches. So, yeah. Yes.
So with the fourth stela, is it, I mean, for us, we would say, oh, that's obviously Nicene Christianity, and he's obviously a Nicene Orthodox Christian king. Is it that obvious to scholars who are looking into this, or is there a debate that that he's sidestepping the political issue and just saying he believes in Jesus?
Nobody had made that connection, because all of the people who were looking at this were not theologically trained.
It's an archaeological find.
It was an archaeological find. It was Stephanie who looked at that and made the connection that this is Nicene Christianity.
Okay.
So
are we still in the percolating? Do you think that will resonate with the Ethiopian church
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That their heritage is Nicene.
No, they are a Nicene church. That's them. And what is cool is that this is actual evidence that grounds that in something tangible, or writes it in stone.
I've only met a few Ethiopian scholars studying here in America. But you've been there, so what's your take on how long the political faction will take to catch up and unify? Because people that I've talked to, I don't get from them. They're not going to say Jesus is fully God and fully man.
Right.
They're not. And that's the confessional criteria.
Right.
And that's how we do intercommunion.
Well, again, you've got the same, even more so in here, in an academic community, it is... You just back away from saying things like that.
Right.
Where it makes a difference is in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. In the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, Ethiopia has almost 100 million people, and probably 45 million or so are Orthodox, which is a huge number.
Right.
So it has been the most influential of the religious bodies in Ethiopia, period, forever. They would be a majority, except for the Protestants have in their mind that Orthodox are not really Christians. So in order to make them Christians, we have to convert them to our form of Protestantism or Pentecostalism. But that's a whole other issue. So, but yeah, it's the evidence is there. In order to make, you know, this isn't a matter of faith. You know, as a historian, I'm not calling anybody to believe that Jesus is God. But I don't need to persuade you that this is what Izana says.
Right.
You see the difference? And as a historian, yes, you say yes. And as a historian, you understand, you know, how that relates to Nicaea, and you understand how that relates to Athanasius. Because you've got not just the stone, but you've got the letter from Constantius too, who's really upset that this outpost of Nicene Christianity is still existing, and he would really like to bring those reel those heretics in, please. So that's how it's, you know, as a Christian and a historian, it only honors my Lord, my faith, when I am a really good historian, when I make sure that I'm very, very careful and I get the evidence and I, you know, make the argument clear. You know, there are people who cut a lot of corners and you know, they bring Christianity into disrepute because they make claims that they can't substantiate.
Right.
And that's a problem. That's why it's so exciting, you know, or so tempting to go jump on the, oh, let's figure out the Ark of the Covenant issue and run down that road. And I haven't even mentioned the Knights Templar showing up in 13th century Lalibela and what were they doing there and, you know, things like that. I mean, you can go into all kinds of speculative conspiratorial stuff. But unless you have evidence, you just better keep your mouth shut. So, yeah.
One more question about modern Orthodoxy in Africa. So how far did Orthodoxy spread in the ancient world? It sounds like what is going on now is an effort to spread Orthodoxy to other parts of Africa, but how far out of Ethiopia, Eritrea, did Orthodoxy go?
Again, that's an excellent question. It's sort of based on the geography. The Aksumite kingdom gradually moved from lowland areas and took refuge in the highland areas, mainly, again, because it was surrounded by hostile groups, hostile Muslims to the north and to the east and to the west, and hostile pagan groups to the south, and eventually hostile Islamic groups to the south, too. And, you know, especially after the 16th century and Ahmed Gran, it became increasingly insular and xenophobic, you know, afraid of outsiders. And even more so when these blasted missionaries kept showing up and trying to bribe and cajole and drag the emperor into becoming Roman Catholic or later Protestant or things like that. And it was like, leave us alone. So they really, it was from their perspective, they felt under attack from all sides. So it, you know, Somalia wasn't conducive to evangelism. You know, it's very, very difficult to for Christians to have an effective witness among Muslims. And we'll let that topic be raised in a week or two.
Yeah, so. Lectures.
Sorry, you'll have to jump up, Father Robert.
Has either yours or your wife's academic work been cited?
Yeah.
By others?
Mm-hmm. Hers has been cited by me. I'd have to go. They have ways of charting that, and I.
I guess the reason I'm asking is to know if it's sort of spurring more interest in some of the things you've talked about tonight, others who are interested in this, who want to pursue, you know, at least parts of you know, the work that you and she have done.
That's a great question, and I have to say I don't know. Very rarely do scholars, I hate to say this, make any difference.
Don't say that to all the students.
In the university setting.
Yeah, don't say that.
No, I mean, we generate a lot of sound and fury, but like Shakespeare says, what does it signify in the scheme of things? It gets more, no, this is being really cynical on my part, but it does add lines to our resumes, which makes us hireable and things like that. That's really, really cynical on my part. That being said, whether or not somebody else picks this up and runs with it doesn't necessarily mean that it is not important or significant in its own sense. And for us, I know for me, the more she shared with me what she was learning and discovering, and you know, we talked about it and things like that, the more amazed I was. You know, because again, as a Westerner, Ethiopia is not on our radar. And as Western Christians, Ethiopian Christianity, you know, is like a less, it seems like a lesser species, because, you know, it, if you're just not familiar with the traditions, it just looks strange. But to see the historicity, to see the depth of faith, to, I mean, when have you heard a ruler talk like Izana? When have you, I mean, it's just remarkable to see that level of Christian faith in action in a kingdom. And that's just a little window there. We just have a little window of one thing that was going on in his life. So it just increased my respect for what was actually going on in Aksum and then in Ethiopia. And, you know, if you've never lived in a place that doesn't have running water or electricity, where the roads are not paved, where you have to get along by donkey, or, you know, there are no shopping malls to go to, you cannot imagine how hard it is to just live and to be, much less to live and be as a Christian in these kinds of things. So my respect, having been there and seen this firsthand, is you know, that it's just awesome what these men and women have done over 1,700 years. There just aren't that many other churches in the world that can trace their lineage back that far. And this one is an African one. So, yeah, I'm going to quit, unless anybody else.
I think we've got time for maybe one more question.
Okay.
I just heard a wonderful anecdote a while back about Lent, the season we're in, that they, in Ethiopia, they didn't really practice Lent because they fasted the... I mean, didn't practice the fast because they fasted all the time. They just didn't have access to meat that much.
As a Protestant, when we went there, we were all scant. We were just... it just blew our mind that they fasted 150 days of the year, or however much it was. It was like, how can you do that? You know? So, but yeah, they do. And by the way, Yitzhak McGibb, Ethiopian fasting food, is some of the best food in the entire world.
So orthodox.
And yes, you can go there, and it's totally orthodox, and it's just awesome. So the sad thing is, we don't have an Ethiopian restaurant here anymore in Charlottesville, do we? We used to. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, even one in Harrisonburg closed.
Blacksburg has one, right?
Have to go up to Washington, I think.
Let's have a little round of applause for Bill.